Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation, joins me to discuss the Supreme Court's disastrous and deliberate inaction on Texas's effective abortion ban and bounty system and what it means for a woman's right to choose going forward.
And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Hey, you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. And when you do, you not only support the free show, you help us thrive and survive, but you also get extra content. This week, I spoke to Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept about the legacy of the 9/11 spying on Muslims in this country, particularly the Fort Dix Five. Very interesting and disturbing stuff, frankly. We'll be talking about 9/11, obviously, this week a little bit and next. So check that out. Become a member today. ROFpodcast.com. So, Heather, another busier week than one would have assumed in the final week of August. In just about, I guess, every silo that one could imagine of American politics, ranging from the end of a 20-year war, at least with ground troops occupying Afghanistan. We also, of course, have had a stark reminder that we are in the midst of climate change and we can expect more and more extreme weather that is going to cost both lives and money in terms of infrastructure and with massive flooding in the Northeast and wildfires and tornadoes and hurricanes in Louisiana losing power. And then, of course, also, we're still in the midst of a pandemic in Louisiana, many other states. We've seen it play over and over again. Healthcare systems at the brink of collapse, more children and people. We're starting to see more vaccinations. We're starting to see Delta burn so quickly that we may have passed the peak in this country for Delta, at least. We also have, we're just days away from a massive unemployment benefit cliff where 8 to 11 million people are going to be looking at suddenly without any benefits. This is coming in the heels of the end of the eviction moratorium. And then lastly, as if to sort of say, like, well, wait a second, this cocktail of American politics and reality, and in many respects insanity, is not quite enough. The Supreme Court sort of backs its way into overturning Roe v. Wade. And let's start there. We are now, we're talking on the second, people are watching this on the third, and it is the second day in which abortion is effectively the Roe v. Wade, which says that a woman has a right to an abortion up until 22 to 24 weeks until a fetus is viable on its own, is effectively done. In Texas, I think most people hopefully by now have heard, in Texas, if a woman gets an abortion after 6 weeks, the state can't do anything about it. State law is actually bars the state from doing anything about it because of a legal maneuver, I guess. We'll talk about that in a bit. But any individual, regardless of whether they're a citizen of Texas or not, any entity can sue anybody involved in that abortion. Whether it's the taxi driver who took the woman to the abortion clinic, whether it's the parent or friend or who took the woman to the abortion clinic, whether it's the abortion doctor, whether it's the abortion facility, theoretically keep going on and on in terms of who abetted this. And the Supreme Court had the opportunity to enjoin this law from beginning because it's clearly a violation of a woman's right to an abortion, and they chose not to. And now my understanding is there is no abortion clinic that's open in Texas at the moment because they're afraid of getting sued out of business. I guess, you know, we knew this was coming, but here it is.
Right. I mean, one way or another, we knew this was coming since 2016, really, when Donald Trump won. And I think that's one of the reasons people remember the big women's march in 2017, with all the pink hats and millions of women took to the streets and backed all over the world. But, you know, particularly in the United States, this was a huge part of that, was the acknowledgement and recognition that the election of Donald Trump meant that there was, number one, there was a Supreme Court seat that was left open through Mitch McConnell's Machiavellian machinations. And they knew that was going to be filled. And then any that would happen during Donald Trump's term would overturn the majority. And of course, we know it happened. That happened when Anthony Kennedy retired and was replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. And you remember the brouhaha about that, of course. And it was all about this. I mean, that was what this was about. I mean, obviously the Women's March was about more, but this was at the center of the concern. I remember the devastation I felt on the morning after the election, knowing that this was coming. Now, you know, it's taken a while and we are about to see, they took a case from Mississippi, which would have banned it, I think, after 15 weeks.
After 15 weeks.
And that was a case we were expecting them. They're going to hear arguments, do it the normal way in the fall. And I have no doubt that they're going to affirm the Mississippi law and overturn at least partially Roe versus Wade and Casey, the law that said that you couldn't place an undue burden on women to get an abortion. So we knew this was coming. This one, though, I think really shocked people, even in the legal community, the abortion, you know, rights groups, everybody, because it is bizarre. It is outrageous. And the implications go way beyond abortion rights, although that is also at the center of this, of course. It's a law about abortion. But the idea that they have found this strange kind of, you know, workaround on it, where you don't have, you know, they didn't, you know, explicitly make a law that went against Roe versus Wade in the sense that the state is not, they made the law, but it can't be enforced by the state. And instead turning it into a civil matter where basically they have legalized vigilantism. That is what we're talking about here. It's vigilantism. It's saying private citizens can now go around, monitor their friends, family, neighbors, anybody they want, go through
total strangers.
Total strangers, anyone. And they can determine that an abortion has taken place and then go and, you know, while they you know, I don't know if they could sue the woman, although one would assume that they could because she certainly...
They can't, oddly enough. They cannot sue there's not a right to sue the woman. It's anyone who abets.
Just the abet. Okay. Well, so they've got, it could be anybody in the woman's life. And in fact, the law is so written so vaguely that I think that it can be even people who didn't know they were abetting the abortion can be sued. So, I mean, that's a wild thing. And it can be sued by anyone in the United States. You don't even have to be in Texas. You could be someone from elsewhere that, you know, could bring the suit. So this is crazy. It is an absolutely crazy and it's a real stretch in any kind of American jurisprudence. This is not something that we do where we take the law enforcement of a law on the books and put it solely in the hands of private citizens to sue civilly. I don't think that exists anymore.
I don't think there's a situation where there is an exclusive right by citizens.
Exactly.
I mean, you have key TAM cases, arguably,
right.
And you have situations where you have mass torts that are, that attorney generals will use private lawyers as a mechanism in which to enforce certain things. But the innovation here is the statute prevents the state from enforcing this so that it can avoid federal jurisdiction.
Right.
And presumably avoid the question of constitutionality. Now, this seems to me to be absurd on its face. It is an abridgment. The state passed the law. Whoever it is that ends up making, you know, abridging the rights of a woman to get an abortion is sort of irrelevant, right? I mean, the state can pass a law that says that you need to have a 30-foot ceiling in your abortion clinic or you're not approved. And it's, you know, I guess maybe the state comes in and it doesn't, but it's the act of the law that is abridging the right. It's not the, the existence of the ceiling per se, right? I mean, because ceilings exist and we deem whether they're legal or not. And so that theory seems to me to also be weak. But more importantly, the Supreme Court decided to just sort of punt or make it seem like they were punting. But when you allow the law to continue, you're allowing Roe v. Wade to be overturned. I mean, how you go about doing it is sort of irrelevant, right? I mean, there's no passivity. There's no passive option here. They voted to not hear the case, claiming that it's too complicated. Now, I mean, there's two sides of this, right? Which is one is, you know, well, there's more than that, actually. But I mean, the fact is you cannot get an abortion in Texas anymore. I mean, your ability has been abridged. And that's where the first, I think, trap laws actually emanated from or was heard by the Supreme Court. Trap laws being targeted restrictions on abortion providers. These were laws that were just to make it impossible for an abortion provider to provide abortions. Didn't outlaw them, but it made it hard. It abridged. And this law does the same exact thing. It's just, you know, they're just because they're using individuals who are incentivized to sue as opposed to the height of a ceiling, it doesn't seem to make a material difference. But nevertheless, this is where we're at. It was expected. I mean, I think any Democratic politician, in any blue state, and I'm looking at New York and California right now, who fails to pass a law incentivizing people to sue people who carry a gun, shoot a gun, people who... I mean, we could go on and on, right? I mean, if it is legal, if it is okay to abridge one constitutional right, if you simply outsource it to people's, you know, ability to sue in the event that that right is exercised, I mean, maybe we should outlaw certain speech, not outlaw, but I mean, just you can sue someone for saying, racially insensitive words.
Donald Trump, you can outlaw, you know, anything like that. Yeah,
exactly. Let's no more MAGA hats. I mean, you can wear them, but if you wear them for more than 15 minutes, I have the right to sue you for $10,000 because it's offensive. If there's not a Democratic lawmaker, at least one in every blue controlled state not drawing up that legislation right now, it is completely political malpractice. And there's going to be other political implications to this too, wouldn't you imagine? I mean, you made the point right there that this is what at least partially drove so many women out on that those first days of the Trump presidency.
Absolutely, there are. And you know, I don't know yet how Democrats are going to react to this. They tend to startle easily and be afraid to actually, you know, run on issues like this. And traditionally, abortion rights has been one of those issues that motivated the right more than it motivated the left. But as I pointed out, in 2017, I believe, and if you looked at the signs and what people were saying in the crowd, this was, you know, the top issue. It was one of the top issues that people were marching in that gigantic march all over the country. So I do think there's a constituency for this. And if you look at the polling, you know, in states all over, you know, they're going to try this, as you said, in states. Florida is already talking about doing it. Florida, a large majority is in favor of abortion rights. This could be
same in Texas. In Texas, frankly. I mean, there's going to be big implications here for this politically. I mean, I got to imagine there are some Republican lawmakers who might be a little bit nervous right now about this.
I think they are. And we already know this because in Virginia, there's a governor's race going on there. The Republican, you know, I don't know. Is he the front runner? Has he been actually nominated? I can't remember his name now. Anyway, he's running against Terry McAuliffe. There is quotes from him saying, you know, kind of off the record, but they got recorded saying, hey, look, you know, I'm with you on abortion, but I can't really run on it because the independents will kill me and I need those voters. And he actually has, you know, he's on the record saying that. So I know that they are concerned about it, certainly in those purple states. And in states where they've got people running in 2022 in swing districts and in swing states. I mean, this is going to be an issue. And when you look at the suburban voters, vast majority are pro abortion rights. Young people, huge majority. I mean, like 70%, anybody under the age of 30, they are totally, of course, this is, the, you know, this is an issue that affects them very personally, you know, young people. And then you've got, you know, you've got women and, you know, women across the board, even Republican women, a lot of them are pro-choice. So this is going to be I think it's going to be an issue. Now, the question is whether or not we see Democrats decide that, you know, I know they love their vaunted kitchen table issues and those are definitely important and it's something they have to run on, but it cannot be exclusive. This culture war stuff, the Republicans are going to
must
push
be engaged.
Culture war stuff. They have to be engaged. You cannot avoid it. You've got to go at it head first and get into it and make your case. So I'm fingers crossed because
well,
I don't.
Let's take a break. And you know, we've got a lot of things to talk about, but I want to just continue on with that theme because I didn't even talk about this at the top of the show, but we still have the January 6th commission going on. There's some interesting things that happening there. And I think that ties in a little bit into what you just said. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Heather Parton. So, Heather, we ended the last segment. We were obviously talking about the ruling by the Supreme Court, which essentially says that Roe v. Wade is no longer operative. And by that, we mean Roe v. Wade said essentially that the right to privacy included a woman's right to choose whether she wants to have an abortion. I mean, presumably among all other medical treatments that she may decide to have. And that it cannot be abridged by any state in the country and or municipality for that matter, or anybody, anybody from the government cannot abridge this this right in any meaningful way. As you said, Casey made it quite clear that you can't do things to make it that, you know, so hard that if you, the right that only exists on paper as opposed to in practice. And this clearly, I mean, we know the abortion clinics are shut down. We know people are going to sue. Everybody knows this. And this law had that effect and the Supreme Court let it stand. And you said that, you know, it would be a massive failure by Democrats not to use this. Amongst other things, but I think this is a pretty powerful and, you know, this is a strong abridgment of a fundamental right that women have in this country. And they should be using it to leverage people getting out and voting against Republicans in the midterm elections. It also occurs to me, as you said, that the same thing is true of Donald Trump. You know, the Republicans are out there. They have created this critical race theory boogeyman to the point where actually in Texas, a black principal of a school was fired, or I should say suspended,
simply based on the accusation that he was teaching critical race theory. He was not. And in addition to apparently a complaint that he had posted a picture of himself with his wife on their anniversary, and his wife happens to be white, and that was deemed to be controversial by the school district. They asked him to take that picture down. And so you have that and the anti-mask fervor, which we can see on a daily basis, has driven these people insane. And it is very reminiscent of the Tea Party showing up at the healthcare town halls. And the Republican Party has successfully riled their base. The Democratic Party needs to rile their base and needs to rile the and make them understand the stakes of it. And the idea of an abridgment of a fundamental right of women seems to be pretty high on the list. The other one, which we also know motivates people, is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is serving himself up. And the biggest, the easiest mechanism for that is the January 6th hearings, it seems to me. They just elevated Liz Cheney, which I have mixed feelings about, and we're going to have to see how that works out. I don't like Liz Cheney. I think she's a reprehensible person, and she was reprehensible before Donald Trump was elected. She was reprehensible even when she came out and spoke against Donald Trump. Good for her. That's the minimum that a person should be doing, and she doesn't even clear that bar. However, if it emboldens the Democrats to continue to pursue things like records from social media companies and in their part of their investigation, which apparently has scared the bejeejis out of the Republicans, I'm all for it because the Democrats, you know, cannot cave on this. They need to pursue this all the way. And if they need to make the election about Donald Trump and a woman's right to choose, because it's going to drive people out, all the better. Simultaneously, we should say that if they are successful, they will also have delivered one of the biggest package of material benefits for the American public in decades in the infrastructure bill, which is still being written as we speak. So, I mean, I think like, this is, you know, they've got a job to do, but there is a clear path, it seems to me.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And the idea, I keep hearing this on social media, you know, why do you elevate Donald Trump? Because I write about him a lot. That's part of the reason. This guy isn't going away. He is part of the conversation. He is still the leader of these people. He's still their inspiration for whatever they're doing, including what they did in Texas down there. Doing an end run around the law is exactly what Donald Trump has inspired the Republican Party to do. And they've been going there for a long time. And he finally just ripped the lid off of it and said, you know, all's fair by any means necessary. So, yes, Donald Trump is part of this conversation. He is part of it. He wants to be part of it. And that's fine. Let him be part of it. He loses elections. He's losing, lose. So do it. 2018 was a great year for Democrats.
And let's be clear, he's not running in 2022. And so he's not going to have the benefit. The Republicans are not going to have the benefit of his ability to drive people to the polls. But Democrats can have the benefit of driving their people to the polls to vote against him as a, like, you know, to vote against Republicans as a surrogate to voting against Donald Trump.
Exactly. And he is a surrogate. He is a surrogate for all these Republicans. He's endorsing people left and right. He's completely making a fool of himself. I mean, I should say, you know, one of the other things that the Democrats have delivered, or Joe Biden specifically, is the withdrawal of military troops from Afghanistan. You know, don't run from it. Run toward it. This was something that people would stop running from your own accomplishments and from the fight that people want you to wage. I mean, you know, you and I have been talking about this for a long time. I mean, it's a constant sort of problem with the Democrats. But in this case, it is vital. They've got to do everything in their power to win this election in 2022. If they don't, you've got Kevin McCarthy in there, who's, you know, God only knows, and Mitch McConnell again. I mean, that's the end of the agenda completely, and a, you know, a movement toward 2024 with some momentum behind it. Honestly, the Democrats really, really need to pull out all the stops. And I think these are winning issues. Look, we are in a contentious period in this country. We're polarized beyond polarized. It's a fight.
Yep.
It's a fight. Fight. Do it. You know, and I don't mean that in a literal sense. They do. But, you know, I'm talking about go out there and make your case and you know, push it as hard as you can. And this is part of the case. And honestly, I think this scared people. This Texas, I get the sense, and granted, you know, what do I know? I mean, it's just anecdotes among people that I know and among watching the, you know, the response on social media, et cetera. I think this Texas decision, I think it's maybe awakened people to the fact that this Supreme Court is dangerous and it is a problem. And, you know, I'm saying, I think the Democrats should run on expanding the court. I think this is actually something they need to work on. They need to talk about it. They need to get it out there into the ether as a real possibility. It's no more radical than what they just did down in Texas and what this Supreme Court endorsed by refusing to block the law. So I don't, you know, okay, if we're going radical, let's have the Democrats put some things on the table that really need to be done to stop it.
Well, and you know, my sense is, I mean, I happen to be very much in favor of expanding the court to 13 seats, actually, based upon how many circuit courts there are. But as a political matter, it seems to me you're going to get, I mean, I think they should talk about that, you know, to contextualize this. But as a political matter, we're on an off year election. There's a lot of state seats that are up to vote, and you can have, like, you know, there should be in states like Florida, in states like Georgia and North Carolina, and states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio. I mean, we can go on and on and on here with states where they're either controlled by Republicans or on the verge of being controlled by Republicans, make every single local member of the Assembly and the Senate in every state, every gubernatorial candidate come out with, where are you on abortion? Because this is the implications. We're going to have, by the end of, well, I don't know how long it's going to take. Maybe it's only going to take another year or so, maybe less. We're going to have, you know, 20 states in this country where abortion is either 100% illegal or effectively outlawed. And that's coming. And the Democrats have the opportunity to drive people out to the polls and not make it something that's like a second order, you know, vote for us and then we will vote to expand the Supreme Court. It is vote for us and we will keep it legal in this state.
Right, right.
And,
good point.
And so there's you know, an opportunity here. I agree with you. I think this permeates, you know, Democrats love to go back to sleep after the big bad boogeyman has gone away. Joe Biden represented that for a lot of people, I think. But and the Democrats and the left broadly have never paid attention to the court in the way that I think that both of us agree that they should have. Mm-hmm. And it has been sort of an obsession of mine. And, you know, I have to concede probably a failure in terms of, like, you know, I'm a communicator of this stuff and people still didn't seem to get it. But here we are at this, and we should say, because we've just run out of time, abortion is a fundamental right for women in this country. But what the Supreme Court can do is even greater than rolling back an individual's right. They're going to attack the relationship between what the government can do to help its citizens as it has stood in this country for 100 years. And they're about to do that. And we're going to see it. People should keep in mind the things called the Chevron Doctrine and the delegation authority. These are things that are going to really fundamentally alter what the government can do to protect its citizens in this country from corporate malfeasance, from poisoning, from drinking dirty water, all of these things. Yeah. So people buckle up. It's going to get a lot more bumpy. Heather, we'll talk more about this next week, I'm sure.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It was great.
We are entering into the most dangerous era for a woman's right to choose in quite a while, on the heels of the Supreme Court's inaction on Texas's nearly entire ban of abortion. Questions remain about the Supreme Court's place in American society and whether Democrats will act in a way that meets the urgency of the moment relative to the court. Here to talk about all of this is Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation, whose piece in The Nation is entitled Starting Tomorrow, Roe v. Wade Will Functionally Cease to Exist in Texas. Welcome to the show, Ellie.
Thank you so much for having me, Emma.
Yeah, so now tomorrow has already happened. So talk a little bit about the implications of this decision.
Yeah, first of all, let's be clear. Roe v. Wade is no longer good law. And the way that we know that is that if Texas's law is allowed to stand, if it's allowed to stand for even an hour, which it has at this point, then there is no way to comport Texas's law with Roe v. Wade. People need to understand what Roe v. Wade actually stands for, what it still stands for, what it used to stand for before Texas, right? Roe v. Wade does not stand for the right for an abortion for anybody. That's not what the case is really about. The case is simply that in Roe v. Wade was simply that the government did not have a right to restrict abortions before fetal viability, which is usually 24, 25 weeks of gestation. That's it, right? Roe v. Wade has already been, if not overturned, significantly weakened in the 90s by a case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey. It is actually Planned Parenthood's doctrine that we live under right now with abortion rights. Planned Parenthood says that while the state cannot outright prohibit abortion before 24 weeks of pregnancy, the state can restrict abortion so long as it does not place a, quote, undue burden on the woman seeking to access her constitutional rights. That's Planned Parenthood, right? So when Texas comes in and says no abortion after 6 weeks, well, that's done. Roe, Casey, that's both of those cases are done, because 6 weeks, a ban after 6 weeks, is a ban that happened significantly before fetal viability at 24 weeks. There is simply no way that Roe can be good law protecting a constitutional right to privacy before 24 weeks of gestation, and for Texas to be a good law banning abortions after 6 weeks. So if Texas's law is the law, then Roe v. Wade is not.
Right. And so, I mean, I think people need to fully understand how restrictive this law is, and we'll get to the bounty element of it in a bit. But for a woman to know that she's pregnant or missed her period, women's periods don't just start on the same day for the most part every 4 weeks. It varies for some women to different degrees. And so I think the minimum you get concerned as a woman if you miss your period is a week late. And so that's 5 weeks already. And now this law is saying that within a week, you have to have set up a procedure, take off work. This is, of course, an immense burden on low-income poor people, as much more so than wealthier people. I mean, that is just the kind of targeted unrealism of this law.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't know. I did not know until my wife was pregnant with our first child, right? That they don't they start counting age of the fetus from the last missed period. So if you only find out that you're pregnant, if you only start to think about being that you might be pregnant after you've missed a period, that fetus is classified as 4 weeks in the day you miss your next period. And again, Emma, that's assuming, as you say, that your periods start like clockwork on the same time at the same, you know, every month, boom, same day, 9:03, here we go. Right. That's assuming that the fetus is already thought to be 4 weeks old. So the Texas law is only allowing a 2 week period. And again, that's for women starting the clock at missing a period. If you're not trying to get pregnant, that's not a lot of time for you to figure out that you might be, to say nothing. And this is another point that I think gets missed a lot, to say nothing of the young women, sometimes girls, who don't have regular periods because they're still quite young.
Still developing, yeah.
Right? And B, are just hoping against hope that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
perhaps not telling friends, not telling family, because they're just hoping, they're wish casting that hopefully this didn't happen to them. This Texas ban basically cuts access to this right out for those women and girls in many cases. Remember, the Texas ban has no exception for rape or incest. It just the barbarism of what Texas is doing it shocks the conscience. And as you were saying, they're make no mistake on how restrictive this ban is, right? Just because they say it's after 6 weeks does not mean that you have 6 weeks to consider whether or not you want to bring a pregnancy to term. You have at best days.
Right.
And these are in states, you know, this is happening in Texas, which already only has, you know, a few abortion providers for, you know, tens of millions of people. We saw on Tuesday night, the day before the law went into effect, Whole Woman's Health, one of the few abortion providers in Texas, was simply overwhelmed with women trying to get procedures done before the law took effect. It's hard to get an appointment at these places within 6 weeks, to say nothing of the few days that you have to make this critical, and I'll emphasize, private decision.
And let's now shift and talk about the burden on, talk about undue burden. I mean, the immense responsibility that is given to people who, in the words of this Texas law, abet abortion. Say you're an Uber driver who drives a woman to her abortion, you could be considered somebody who's aiding and abetting an abortion. Say you're a family member who drives that woman to her abortion, or girl to her abortion, you could be considered a part of this evil criminal scheme, according to Texas law. Expand on that a bit, Ellie, if you could.
So the way that conservatives think that they're clever here is that they've shifted the enforcement mechanism of their abortion ban away from the state and to private citizens. They've literally empowered a vigilante force of private citizens to have a cash bounty on people suspected of providing abortions, or as you put it, aiding and abetting the procurement of an abortion. So if I am a citizen, and by the way, I don't have to be a citizen of Texas to partake in this bounty. If I am just a random citizen of America, and I suspect somebody in Texas of aiding and abetting an abortion.
Or say you're an outside group, a well-funded Heritage Foundation arm, for example.
You know, don't even, like, let's not even start that thinking that I might have some money behind it.
Oh, right.
Right? And I suspect a person in Texas of aiding or abetting an abortion, I can sue them civilly. And if I win, they have to pay me $10,000 plus attorney's fee. They were creating a cash incentive for me to go out and find somebody to sue for aiding and abetting an abortion. So after they sue all of the abortion providers, which, you know, is going to happen almost immediately, who do you think they're going to come for next? That's where they come for the Uber driver, the receptionist at Planned Parenthood. That's where they come for people on Twitter or Instagram providing information about where you can still get an abortion or how, if that Twitter user or Facebook user happens to live in Texas. That person is going to get sued under this bounty system.
Yes, it's absolutely nuts. And it also, I mean, one, so first they want to come for women who want to get their abortion. They're making it basically impossible to do so. Now they're trying to essentially bankrupt these clinics and providers out of existence. And then also going after people who might be helping in women getting an abortion. So it is as extreme as it gets. But the part that just blows my mind is, how is it possible to prove that anybody has standing to sue somebody else for just an abortion having happened. How does that hold up in our legal system as somebody who covers this very extensively?
It doesn't at all.
Right.
None of this does. Like, you can't deputize. We do not have a vigilante force in this country. You can't deputize vigilantes. And since we're talking about Texas, usually armed vigilantes, because let's not forget, on the same day that the abortion ban passed, Texas also passed their law prohibiting gun licensing. So literally today in Texas, a uterus is more heavily regulated than an assault rifle, just saying. So not only is it patently illegal to deputize the enforcement powers of the state to armed vigilantes roving around there as private citizens, you're absolutely right. There's no possible standing that these people can have. And just for your viewers who aren't lawyers, and congratulations on not being a lawyer, you made a wise decision with your life. standing is the concept that you basically have to have a reason. You have to have kind of a legal reason to be involved in a case or controversy in the first place, right? You can't sue people just because you don't like what they're doing, right? If an easy example is, let's say my town has noise pollution laws, right? You're not allowed to play your stereo certain decibels after 9 p.m. at night, right? Well, if I don't live in the town, I don't get to go sue a person for having a stereo that's too loud, right? I have to have some kind of skin in the game before I'm allowed to make a legal complaint. The Texas law throws that out of the window on its head and basically acts like any U.S. citizen has grounds to regulate what happens inside a woman's body. And that is why, and you know, I talk about this a lot, and it's a critical point. That's why I refuse to call the people who support these laws pro-lifers. This has nothing to do with life. This has nothing to do with somebody's religious belief about conception and when the soul is imparted to the. This has nothing to do with that. This has everything to do with controlling women's bodies. There is not one aspect of this that has anything to do with life, because if it had something to do with life, instead of paying people $10,000 to go rat up their neighbor suspected of talking about abortion, they'd pay women who want to take their pregnancy to the term $10,000 in free healthcare. That's what you do if you cared about life. You give women money to have women who are pregnant money so that their pregnancies can continue with as much health and care and comfort as possible. That's life. That's not what Texas is doing. Texas is all about controlling women's bodies and letting anybody do it.
Yeah. And we're trying to kind of do a version of this on the national level, or at least the left is, under President Biden, with the child tax credit. That's what you do when you're interested in preserving lives. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk more now about the Supreme Court's role in this. We'll be right back. So before we broke, we were talking about the insanity of this law saying that incentivizing through cash anybody and everybody, probably very well-funded right-wing groups, as a part of a targeted campaign to get their base galvanized and to punish abortion providers and people seeking abortions, and how basically the law, it just stands up to zero. It doesn't stand up to any legal scrutiny. And that's why the Supreme Court's refusal to do anything about this, to sit on their hands and not stay this law from going into effect, is so brazen and egregious and ideological in a way that they pretend not to be. Talk about that. Talk about their decision not to move or do anything at all. I mean, The charitable view is that they're going to address this when they take up the Mississippi law in Dobbs v. Jackson for Women's Health Organization, which is coming up soon. But I mean, this is so egregious on multiple grounds, the standing aspect, and then, of course, the fact that it completely violates precedent in Roe. Like, how is that justified?
Yeah, everybody who told you, and I'm looking at you, Susan Collins, everybody who told you that the conservative justices would respect precedent were lying to you. Either they were directly with intent lying to you, or they were actual idiots, because all that's happening right now is conservative justices doing what they were appointed to do, which is to take away abortion rights. Roe v. Wade has been precedent for 60 years. It is good, double-binded, double-secret probation, good law, all right? There's no argument that the Texas ban or other bans in other states are even within the pale of what Roe v. Wade or Planned Parenthood v. Casey allows. So when the conservative justices are allowing these laws to go through, what they are doing is ignoring decades of settled precedent, just for starters. Of course, that's what the Supreme Court was, that's what the conservatives were sent here to do. It is worth noting, this year in 2021, while Democrats are in control of the White House and both houses of Congress, this year in 2021, so far, has been the largest amount of abortion restrictions ever in our nation's history in a calendar year. Now, why is that? Is it because Joe Biden won? No, it's because Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Ruth Bader Ginsburg died in September of 2020, and 2021 has seen the largest increase in abortion restrictions in the nation's history. That is a one-to-one connection. Republicans are doing this because they think they can get away with this because they think the Supreme Court finally has its back.
And this is a part of a tried and true tactic where these conservative groups throw everything and anything at the wall to see what sticks when it comes to the Supreme Court. With abortion laws, these state legislatures will pass these restrictive measures that they know are not legal under Roe's precedent, but they're just hoping that they will be able to overturn it and just taking a shot in the dark. But it's not as much a shot in the dark anymore, as you say, because Amy Coney Barrett, who is an ideologue, is now in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat, and it's a 6-3 court. So the dynamics have changed.
Donald Trump promised to only appoint judges who opposed women's rights. Do you think he was wrong? Do you think he got it wrong with Neil Gorsuch or Amy Coney Barrett or alleged attempted rapist Brett Kavanaugh? Do you think he was wrong about them? I think he was right about them. I think they do, in fact, oppose women's rights. And so do the legislatures of Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi and Missouri. They also think that Donald Trump was right about these people and what they're going to do. The other aspect here, though, and the one way that we have for hoping that maybe eventually this Texas law gets knocked down, is because, as you pointed out, Emma, they had a different way they were going to take away abortion rights already set up. This Texas law kind of came out of nowhere from a kind of court watching perspective, insofar as most people, not me, but most people thought that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which already is one of the most conservative courts in the country, that the Fifth Circuit would overturn the Texas law because its system and its bounty system and its 6-week ban is so beyond the pale of other things that are being considered. They thought the Fifth Circuit would do the work for them. The Supreme Court already has a case that it's going to hear this year called Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health, which is a case coming out of Mississippi. Mississippi has a 15-week ban. Again, 15 weeks, still well ahead of the fetal viability standard set in Roe. The Mississippi briefs, the state, has also asked the Supreme Court to directly overturn Roe in that case. And most people thought that the Supreme Court was going to kill Roe in that case, in the Dobbs case, because that would allow them what I always figured they would do. They would kill Roe without killing Roe, right? In the same way that I just said that Roe has functionally not been the law of the land since the 90s, because Planned Parenthood v. Casey is actually the doctrinal structure that we live under, this idea that you can restrict abortions before fetal viability, as long as you don't place an undue burden on the woman. What I thought the court was going to do in Dobbs was just say that banning abortions after 15 weeks doesn't create an undue burden on the woman seeking an abortion. It would be kind of legal gobbledygook, but it would allow them to both allow for the restrictive Mississippi ban without having to say in writing, Roe v. Wade is hereby overturned. And if you don't write Roe v. Wade is hereby overturned, well, then guess what? The New York Times doesn't write that. The Washington Post doesn't write that. The Wall Street Journal doesn't write that. And people don't know that their rights have been taken away from them. And that's what I think the Supreme Court wanted to do. This Texas thing and the Fifth Circuit going straight YOLO kind of changed the timeline a little bit. And whether or not the Supreme Court at any point wants to wrest the timeline back for itself, we still have to see.
Well, that brings us to a bit of an existential question about the court. Because I, for as long as I can remember, I think I was aware of the fiction that the court is an apolitical body that just operates on judicial philosophies, one of judicial conservatism and one of judicial activism. Now, I mean, the more you learn, of course, I mean, I'm in this business and I've known this for quite a while, but there are still a lot of people who might not fully understand how politicized and how divorced from any of those kinds of highfalutin notions of how courts are supposed to operate that the Supreme Court is. I mean, this doesn't get overturning Roe, overturning precedent. It doesn't get more judicially activist than that, because you are literally doing what judicial conservatives like Scalia pretended they were against. Just talk about that enormous hypocrisy and I guess revelations about who they truly are.
It doesn't get more judicially activist than overturning abortion rights. It doesn't get more judicially activist than overturning the Voting Rights Act. I mean, remember, this same Supreme Court, John Roberts in 2013, overturned Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. That's the one that allowed for preclearance, that made states have to, former Confederate states, have to ask before they change their voting rights law. John Roberts issuing that decision in 2013 is the still underreported reason why Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016. It wasn't economically aggrieved white diners in Ohio that brought it home for him. It was suppressed votes in the former Confederacy that allowed Republicans to retake states like North Carolina. That's why Donald Trump won the election in 2016. So they did that in 2013 with Shelby County. And then just this past summer, the court significantly weakened Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which basically made it illegal to be discriminatory in voting laws. Samuel Alito actually wrote that being a little bit discriminatory in your voting rights laws is now okay.
Well, didn't he also say, well, this is what Congress's intent was back then? Like, it's just so ridiculous. He was assuming and hypothesizing about the internal hearts and minds of senators from the 60s. It was just, like, ridiculous.
Yeah, when you talk about judicial activism, the voting rights law was passed, the most recent update to the Voting Rights Act was passed in 2006 by a voice vote in Congress, which is basically unanimous, and something like 93-6 in the United States Senate, and signed by George W. doesn't care about black people Bush. So that's the level of broad-based consensus support the voting rights had as recently as 2006, that the court actively disregarded in both 2013 and this past summer. So the suggestion that the court is some kind of like legal heads in jars above the fray, above the fray of common partisan politics, it's just, not only is it wrong, it's an active lie. It's an active lie pushed by people who don't want you to understand what the court is doing and how the court is taking your rights away. Like that it's not an idle lie. It's not a lie born out of stupidity. It's a lie born out of maliciousness. They want people to not understand what's happening. And so they say, oh, actually the court doesn't make political decisions. Please, and makes political decisions every day.
Lastly, we spoke about this a bit before the show, but this notion of expanding the court, or more controversially named packing the court, is seen as untouchable by a great majority of the Democratic Party, despite all of the tactics used by the Republicans to seize control of the court and ensure that only conservative nominees get through. And this just isn't just the Supreme Court, by the way. These other lower courts, the Republicans have stacked with conservative judges straight out of these right-wing think tanks and groups, which the liberals don't have an equivalent for. Why should that not be controversial anymore?
Because court expansion, court packing, court reform, whatever you want to call it, is the only way to stop them. It's the only constitutional way to stop them. The number of justices on Supreme Court has changed 7 times in our nation's history. The number of justices on the lower courts, we used to add justices there once every 20 or 30 years or so, because our population kept expanding. The Judicial Conference, which is a nonpartisan group of former federal judges, says at a minimum, we need 75 more lower court justices today. Right now, we need 75, they're saying. And quite frankly, if you just look at our population numbers, we need 200 or 250, I think, lower court judges, just to bring our number of judges back in line with our number of people back to where they were in the 90s, all right? That's for the lower courts. For the Supreme Court, I will just point out again that Mitch McConnell stole a seat from President Barack Obama when he refused to give Merrick Garland even a hearing after Antonin Scalia died. Then, after Donald Trump won, they pushed forward Neil Gorsuch. Then, when Anthony Kennedy retired while being in perfect health, just because he wanted to give a slot to his protege turned out to be Brett Kavanaugh, who was accused of attempted rape and perjury and gambling debts and a whole bunch of other stuff. Then, having stolen a seat from Barack Obama, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away in September of 2020, after the election to replace Donald Trump had already started, they pushed through another justice, this time Amy Coney Barrett. That's 3 illegitimate or
well, using or the reasoning using the reasoning that McConnell had used before, which is, oh, we can't for some reason see the Supreme Court justice during an election, did the same thing during the 2020 election.
So at a bare minimum, you need 3 just to balance the scales. I actually support 10. And the reason why I think that we need at least 10 more justices is because if you look at our system, it is clear that our judicial confirmation system is broken. And one of the reasons our judicial confirmation system is broken is because each justice is entirely too important and too powerful. It's political malpractice to not go to the mattress over these judges that will serve for life, 30, 40 years, a generation's worth of legal manipulation. You have to go to the mat every time one of them dies. If there were 10, if there were 19 justices on the court, if there were 21, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that covers California, Arizona, a bunch of other Western states, they've got 29 justices. They work just fine. Why can't we have that many? The thing that people most often say to me when I promote court packing is like, oh, well, if we pack the courts, won't Republicans do the same? Man, how is that worse than what we have now?
Yeah, who cares?
Right? Right now, the Republicans control the courts for a generation. If the Democrats pack the courts and Republicans repack the courts, what's going to happen? The Republicans are going to control the courts for a generation?
It's the filibuster argument. It's the same thing. What's going to happen? Right? Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation. Ellie, thank you so much for your time today and your passion. I really appreciate it and share it.
Thank you for having me, Emma.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire podcast. Hey, if you're listening to the free show right now, you're missing all the bonus content our members enjoy on a weekly basis. Go to rofpodcast.com now and become a member. It's your support that keeps us moving forward. On behalf of Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. Have a great weekend.
There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day. Preachers on the podium speaking of saints. Prophets on the sidewalk begging for change. Old ladies laughing from the fire escape. Cursing my name.